Our first paper is entitled 21 Years of UFO Reports. It's by Professor J. Allen Hynek, who's chairman of the Department of Astronomy and director of the Lindheimer Astronomical Research Center at Northwestern University. Professor Hynek.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My role here today is that of a reporter, to report to you on my score or so years of experience with UFO reports. Note that I don't say UFOs. I was asked in 1948, as an astronomer, to review the UFO reports received by the Air Force to determine how many of them originated from misperceptions of astronomical objects. This consultancy continued across the years and gave me the chance to monitor the flow of UFO reports submitted to the Air Force and to observe the Air Force handling of the problem as first one, then another officer took charge of Project Blue Book. As a reporter of the UFO scene, I am reminded of the old dictum of the reporter, who, what, where, when, and why. I will have no difficulty in dealing with the who, what, where, and when, for that simply means dealing with facts, particularly with the incontrovertible fact that UFO reports exist, and that the time and location of the reported event is generally known, as well as the identity of the witnesses. When, however, we get to the why, well, I shall leave that to the rest of the speakers. But I shall challenge their explanations if they, the speakers, are not conversant with the first four, the who, what, where, and when. Over the course of years, I have grown very weary of the pontifications by those who have not done field work and are not really familiar with the facts. Indeed, I would like to say a word here about scientific methodology as it pertains to UFOs. I've discussed this at length with the noted Canadian philosopher of science, Thomas Gouge, and he has written, "One of the most interesting facets of the UFO question to me is its bearing on the problem of how science advances. Roughly, I would say that a necessary condition of scientific advance is that allowance must be made for A, genuinely new empirical observations, and B, new explanation schemes, including new basic concepts and new laws." Gouge then points out that any successful explanation scheme, including 20th century physics, acts somewhat like an establishment and tends to resist admitting genuinely new empirical observations, particularly when they have not been generated within the framework of that explanation scheme. As, for instance, the reluctance to admit meteorites, fossils, the circulation of the blood, and in our times, ball lightning. History is replete with such examples. Or if the establishment does quickly accept such new observations, it tends to assimilate them into the going framework, as, for instance, the attempt to admit the existence of meteorites as stones that had been struck by lightning, thus implying that there was nothing really new in the observations. Hence, Gouge concludes, the present establishment view that UFO phenomena are either not really scientific data at all, or at any rate, not data for physicists, or else are nothing but misperceptions of familiar objects, events, etc. To take this approach is surely to reject a necessary condition of scientific advance, Gouge concludes. Now, one can never know whether UFO reports represent genuinely new empirical observations, however, if one commits the type of logical fallacy strikingly demonstrated in the following Air Force analysis of a radar visual UFO report from Kirtland Air Force Base. Two control tower personnel reported at 11 p.m. an object which looked to them, through binoculars, like a lighted, upended automobile, came to within 200 feet of the ground when it disappeared behind a fence in a highly restricted area. It then rose abruptly at a very high angular rate and disappeared. It was observed visually for about 6 minutes, about half of that time through binoculars, its trajectory tracked both visually and in part by radar. The Air Force ascribed this sighting to aircraft, but here is what the officer who investigated the case reported. Quote, "The two sources are airways operations specialists with a total of 23 years' experience. Both were on duty in the control tower at Kirtland Air Force Base when the sighting was made. Both appeared to be mature and well-poised individuals, apparently well above average intelligence and temperamentally well qualified for the demanding requirements of control tower operators. Although completely cooperative and willing to answer any question, both sources appear to be slightly embarrassed that they could not identify or offer an explanation of the object which they are unshakably convinced they saw. In the opinion of the interviewer, both sources are considered completely competent and reliable." Project Blue Book gave the following reasons for calling the object an ordinary aircraft, and I quote, "One, the observers are considered competent and reliable sources, and in the opinion of the interviewer, actually saw an object they could not identify. Two, The object was tracked on a radar scope by a competent operator. 3. The object does not meet identification criteria for any other phenomenon. So the witnesses were solid, the radar operator competent, and the object unidentifiable as any other phenomenon, and therefore the object had to be an aircraft. Clearly, if such reasoning is applied to all UFO reports, we can hardly expect to find out whether any genuinely new empirical observations exist to be explained. Schrödinger, father of quantum mechanics, wrote, "The first requirement of a scientist is that he be curious. He must be capable of being astonished and eager to find out." Perhaps he should have added, "and be ready to examine data even when presented in a bewildering and confusing form." There's much in the UFO problem to be astonished about and much to be confused about, too. It is quite understandable how such confusion has arisen. Over the past 20 years, I have had such a sufficiency of experience with crackpots, visionaries, religious fanatics, that I hardly need be further reminded of people who espouse the idea of UFOs as visitors from outer space for their own peculiar purposes. You will note that I say espouse the idea, not make UFO reports. Very rarely do members of the lunatic fringe make UFO reports. There are many reasons for this, but primarily, it is simply that they are quite incapable of composing an articulate, factual, and objective report. In addition to being fully aware of the cultists and the manner in which they muddy the waters, even though they don't generate UFO sightings, I am also quite aware of the widespread ignorance of many people about astronomical objects, high-altitude balloons, special air missions, mirages, special meteorological effects, and of their willingness to ascribe the viewing of such to the presence of something mysterious. These people, as contrasted to the crackpots, are far more of a factor in the UFO problem because they do generate reports, which represent a high noise level, so high, in fact, that many who have not looked carefully into the matter are quite satisfied that all UFO reports stem from such misperceptions. The facts in the case, however, are that it is relatively simple for an experienced investigator to sort out and quickly eliminate nearly all of the misperception cases. It is a pity that people so often are not informed, objective, and accurate reporters. I have been looking at UFO reports since 1948, and I am nauseatingly familiar with UFO reports spawned by Venus, twinkling stars, aircraft, etc. Some 18 years before the Condon Committee was formed, I was already aware that the great majority of UFO reports were indeed nothing more than misperceptions by the uninformed. Such reports, of course, must be deleted before any serious study of the UFO question can begin. Let it be clearly underlined that from this moment on, I am speaking only of UFO reports which remain unexplained by trained investigators. Then and only then are we truly dealing with something that is unidentified, and unidentified by people capable of making an identification. In short, a UFO report must pass through a severe filtering process before it qualifies as worthy material for scientific study, the objective of which is to determine whether any genuinely new empirical observations exist, whether there truly is a UFO phenomenon. Only those reports which survive the running of this gauntlet can qualify. You may immediately object. Aren't you just rejecting everything but the tail end of the distribution curve of human reactions to visual stimuli? Well, we can hold that assumption that we are dealing with the vagaries of human perception only if we believe that we deal with a homogeneous set of observations. That is, the tail of the distribution curve must belong to the same universe or sample of data. Otherwise, it is like examining the distribution curve of the sizes of oranges and trying to fit watermelons onto the curve. Let us define the UFO phenomenon, the existence of which we wish to determine or deny, as that phenomenon described by the contents of reports of observations of lights or objects in the air or near to or on the ground, whose presence, trajectories, and general character are not explainable in verifiable physical terms, even after intensive study. The Condon report furnishes us with many examples. For years, I strongly resisted accepting the idea that a genuine UFO phenomenon might exist. As my review of UFO reports continued, and as they grew in number to be of statistical significance, I became increasingly aware that the phenomenon of UFO reports not only persisted in this country, but in many areas over the world, and that it didn't disappear as one might expect a craze or a fad to disappear. And it began to concern me that if there were some worldwide compulsion to report strange things, why this particular subset of strange reports out of an infinite universe of possible strange reports? The degree of strangeness is certainly one dimension of a filtered UFO report. The higher the strangeness index, the more information elements which defy explanation in ordinary physical terms the report contains. The other dimension, or coordinate, is the probability that the report refers to a real event. In short, did the strange thing that defies explanation in normal physical terms really happen? What is the probability that the witnesses described an actual event of high strangeness? This represents a different evaluation, not of the report this time, but of the witnesses, and involves different criteria. The criteria I have used in determining the coordinates of points to be included in the what you might call the strangeness probability diagram are these. For strangeness, how many individual items or information bits does the report contain which demand explanation, and how difficult is it to explain them on the assumption that the event occurred? For probability, the criteria, integrating over several witnesses, what is their collective objectivity? How do they respond to tests of ability to gauge angular sizes and angular speed? What is the condition of their eyesight? What are their medical histories? What technical training have they had? What is their general reputation in the community? What is their reputation for publicity seeking, for veracity? What is their occupation, and how much responsibility does it involve? And one very important rule that I always impose is that no reports from single witnesses ever get higher than half-scale credibility or probability. Now, if one plots the strangeness of a report against the credibility of the witnesses, or against essentially the same thing, the probability that the event happened, more or less as stated, one obtains an interesting scatter diagram, which might be called the strangeness probability diagram, or sigma pi diagram for short. If we had a slide, I'd like to show that. I guess I caught him a little unaware there. Now, all points plotted represent UFO reports that have passed through the misperception and hoax filter. Clearly, the most provocative and potentially scientifically important are UFO reports are those that contain many strange information elements and have a high probability rating. Reports for which the witnesses were of such a caliber and the circumstances surrounding the reported event were such as to make it virtually impossible to discount the reported event. Examples of strange information bits are craft descriptions, reported violations of inertial laws, ability to affect animals, to interfere with automobile ignition systems, and to leave visible marks on land and on cultivated fields. The Condon report includes several such cases. Of course, right off the bat, this is my own subjective evaluation of somewhat more than 100 cases. I could have chosen many others, but this seemed to be a representative group. The strangeness and the abscissa, the probability or credibility, the ordinate. The symbols will be explained very shortly. In my own long experience in personal contact with witnesses, one paramount thing has impressed me above all, and that is that those witnesses who generate high sigma pi reports, those would be more in the 10 in the upper right-hand general area, that those people who generate these reports are all trying to describe an event for the description of which they have an entirely inadequate vocabulary, much as an aborigine would lack the vocabulary to describe a supersonic jet or a nuclear submarine. Whatever else can be said of the UFO phenomenon, it represents for the witness an undoubted event, and an event for which he was totally unprepared. The majority of such witnesses, contrary to popular belief, were originally highly skeptical about UFOs. Suddenly they had an experience which profoundly affected them, sometimes traumatically. Speaking again from years of experience with witnesses, I can say that faced with the experience of a UFO event, the witnesses are generally perplexed and uncertain as to what to do about it. Invariably, they attempt to explain it in ordinary terms first and fail. Curiosity overwhelms them, yet they know only too well that they will be targets for ridicule if they report, for as they confess, they have often in the past ridiculed others. Generally, they confide only in their own family, if at all, and they often prefer to remain silent. Sometimes they will finally report observations years after they occurred. Any serious investigator is aware that a reservoir of latent reports must exist. Not only has the Gallup poll so indicated, but I frequently tried the experiment of asking for a show of hands of those who either themselves or their close friends had a puzzling UFO experience. I generally find that more than 10% of the audience will raise a hand. But when I ask for hands of all those who reported the event in some official manner, I find virtually no hands raised. Judging from this and other personal observations, I would estimate that for every officially reported UFO sighting, there exist many dozens that have gone unreported. I believe that as scientists, we should be astonished that high Sigma Pi reports even exist. What does a serious person holding a valued reputation stand to gain by making such a report? Why do people go to the trouble of filling out questionnaires, of subjecting themselves to sometimes hostile inquiry, and of being the target of unpleasant attention? The reason appears to be twofold. Witnesses have told me that they had not intended to say anything about their experience, but they felt that it might be of importance to the government or to science, and felt it their duty to report. The second reason is curiosity. They want to know whether anyone else experienced the same event and whether the event has a rational explanation. They are visibly reassured when I tell them, if it be the case, that their sighting fits a pattern and resembles other reported sightings from various parts of the world. What about patterns of UFO reports? Clearly, if each UFO report represents a unique happening, the UFO is not amenable to scientific study. Classification of UFO reports, however, must be free of any preconceived ideas as to their nature and cause. Thus, the classification must be observational. It should be akin to the state of the classification of stellar spectra in the days before we had a theory of stellar spectra, or somewhat like the classification of galaxies is today. I have adopted a simple classification system based solely on the manner of observation. There seem to be four basic ways in which the UFO presents itself, so to speak, for human observation. One, as nocturnal lights, the objects to which the lights are presumably attached being generally barely, if at all, discernible. Two, as daytime disks, when the UFO generally, though not necessarily, appears as a disk or oval. Three, as close encounters during day or night. These are reported sightings made at ranges less than 1,000 feet and often accompanied by reported physical effects on the land, on plants and animals, and occasionally on humans. And four, radar UFOs, a special subset of which is the radar visual observation, an example of which I gave earlier. There's no attempt in this observation classification to be mutually exclusive. Clearly, a nocturnal light might be a daylight disk in the daytime, and so on. The nocturnal light report has the least information elements, and thus a low strangeness index. The nocturnal light are the stars, or asterisks, in the diagram. The nocturnal light can be defined as a light or combination of lights whose kinematic behavior passes through the filter. That is, it cannot be logically ascribed to balloons, aircraft, meteors, planets, satellites, satellite reentries, or missiles. The experienced investigator generally has no difficulty with the screening process here. Of course, should a UFO choose to masquerade as a hot air balloon or a photographic night air exercise, there is no easy way of differentiation, at least as long as we are limited to observing from the ground. If we had immediate reaction capabilities and could scramble an interceptor, we could clear the matter up quickly. Or perhaps we would experience what has often been reported. You'll notice in all these cases I'm saying reported because I'm dealing with reports and what was reported to have happened, and I do not want to fall in the trap of saying it happened. It was always what was reported to have happened. Or perhaps we would experience what has often been reported in the past 20 years. As the intercepting plane approaches the light in question, the light either suddenly goes out or seems to take off and soon outdistances the investigator. As an example of a nocturnal light, we have a case I investigate personally involving five witnesses, the senior witness being the longtime associate director of a prominent laboratory at MIT. The nocturnal light was first sighted by his son, who had been out airing the dogs. He came bounding into the house crying, "There's a flying saucer outside." The senior observer picked up a pair of binoculars on his way out. He told me that he didn't expect to see anything unusual, but was going out to see what the commotion was all about. He was engrossed by what he saw, the nature of the light, its motions, its hovering, and its departure. He described the light as having a high color temperature, although essentially a point source, suspending less than a minute of arc. The five observers were fortunately able to compare it to an airliner and a helicopter, both of which passed by during the observation interval. And neither the motions nor lights of these craft bore any resemblance to those of the UFO, or I should say the reported UFO. The trajectory of the object was plotted against the framework of the branches of a denuded tree. This observer was a good one, and in his report included the condition of his eyes and that of the members of his family. The adult observers were both farsighted, and the senior observer wore glasses only for reading. Incidentally, all my attempts as scientific consultant to the Air Force to mount a serious investigation of this case came to naught. The Blue Book evaluation is, however, unidentified. But somehow the word unidentified is not, for them, a challenge to inquiry. It has been classified as unidentified, and therefore the case is solved. It has been identified as unidentified. So certain was the Air Force, at least publicly, that all UFO reports must represent normal things, that they saw no point to serious investigation. And most of the time that I acted as consultant of the Air Force, I repeatedly urged immediate reaction capability and proper scientific investigation, but to no avail. The next classification category is the daylight disk. Daylight disks are the circles, the open circles. The prototype report runs something like this, and there's hundreds. I was driving along, and there crossed over in front of me a shiny metallic disk. It seemed about 500 to 1,000 feet above the road. It came down very close to the ground, stopped and hovered with a wobbling motion, then took off with incredible speed, straight up, and was gone in a few seconds. There was no noise. This daylight category, quite understandably, has more photographs to support it than all the others put together. An example is the McMinnville, Oregon case, which the Condon Report lists as unsolved, but I understand by private conversation with Dr. Hartman that the analysis was not entirely complete, and the McMinnville, Oregon case may yet turn out to be a hoax. A photographic daylight disk case was reported by three prospectors in the bush country near Calgary, Alberta. I personally investigated this terrain by flying over it in a small plane. I investigated the witnesses, the negatives, and the camera. All this, plus the sworn affidavit of the principal witness, leads me to put this into the class of a good daylight disk. But as with so many other cases, one is finally impaled by uncertainty. Many photographs have been published. Some are patent hoaxes, but most have never been investigated sufficiently to rule out very sophisticated hoaxes. Proper interrogation, tracing of the processing history of the negative, microscopic and microphotometric examination of the negative, plus proper psychological testing of the witnesses to the taking of the photograph, should serve to rule out all but the most highly sophisticated, expensive, and elaborately contrived hoaxes. Now, in any one case, it is clearly impossible to state unequivocally that a photo of a daylight disk is genuine. But I would submit that 25 such separate photographic cases, each subjected to exhaustive tests, would allow us to approach certainty asymptotically, so that we could say that the probability of a hoax in all 25 cases was vanishingly small. Even so, this would not prove the existence of truly strange flying objects. But it should provide sufficient justification for the proper attention to the phenomenon by the scientific world. And let me remind you that that is all I have ever advocated, that the subject of UFO reports is worthy of serious scientific attention. Inherent in the sheaves of UFO reports, there may well be many doctoral dissertations for physicists, sociologists, and psychologists alike. The problem is interdisciplinary, which, because of the magic of that word, ought to get some of you some good grants. The third category of UFO reports, the close encounter, offers by far the greatest potential for scientific study. It is here that the hypothesis of simple misperception fails utterly in explaining reports of craft landing 100 feet away, of visible marks left on the ground, of animals and people visibly affected, and of automobiles temporarily stopped on the road. Here we must say either that the witnesses were severely mentally unbalanced, or that something most interesting actually happened. I divide the close encounter case into three subdivisions. The close encounter pure and simple, which is up here, the C's, close encounter. And you see, the close encounter gives you more information bits, and hence strangeness index goes up. The close encounter with physical effects, those are the P's for physical effects. And finally, the close encounter in which humanoids or occupants enter the picture. It is this latter subgroup which, of course, has the highest strangeness index and frightens away all but the most hardy investigators. Since my role here is that of reporter, I would be neither a good reporter nor scientist were I to deliberately reject data. There are now on record some 1,200 reports of close encounters, nearly half of which involve reported craft occupants. Reports of occupants have been with us for years, but there are only a few in the Air Force files, for generally Blue Books summarily and without investigation consign such reports to the psychological, which is their term for crackpot. A prototype of the close encounter per se is that of the witnesses driving along a lonely road when the driver spies a strange glare in his rearview mirror. He becomes frightened, increases his speed to sometimes to over 100 miles an hour, trying to outdistance the UFO but cannot. He stops the car and the witnesses try to take cover. Shortly, the light goes away, rising and vanishing quickly in the distance. One can charge that such witnesses were mentally unbalanced. I have found it most difficult to try saying that to their faces, especially when I discovered that the witnesses were respected members of their communities and held responsible positions. If you're going to say they're crazy, prepare to run. The close encounter with physical effects interests me the most, since the reported effects on animal, vegetable, and mineral are potentially measurable. For instance, there are more than 100 reports on record of UFOs that reportedly caused car ignition failures. The all-too-typical case runs something like this. Suddenly, as if from nowhere, a bright light appears. As it stops to hover over the car lights dim or fail, and the engine dies, the radio either stops and has a lot of static on it, and the windshield wipers stop. Often, the occupants of the car report feeling hot and prickly. After a few minutes, the apparition leaves and the car returns to normal operation, but the witnesses often do not. Attempts to explain such cases as a misperception of the moon and the inadvertent killing of the engine by an excited witness doesn't wash. The moon doesn't stop windshield wipers on a rainy night, nor does the killing of the engine dim the lights or produce static on the radio. Witnesses of such encounters do not readily lend themselves to interrogation. Often they tell no one for days. Eventually, a serious UFO investigator comes to hear about it, and then the story unfolds. When they do unwisely tell their story openly, their lives are invariably made miserable by ridicule. Let us consider the probabilities in car failure cases, in reported car failure cases. On a cross-country trip, we occasionally come across a car disabled by the roadside, its hood up, waiting for the repairman or the tow truck. We should regard it as odd and of low probability were the car to heal itself, so to speak, and after a few minutes proceed as if nothing had happened. Now, however, if we impose the further condition that the event must be accompanied by a very bright, unexplained light which hovers over the car, then I submit that such probabilities are extremely small. And when we deal not with two or three such cases, but many dozens, we are driven, I at least am driven to the conclusion, that something most extraordinary happened, either physical or psychological. If we have in these cases what Dowge calls genuinely new empirical observations requiring new explanation schemes, then we can anticipate not merely a scientific breakthrough, but one enormous quantum jump, which will make the transition from classical physics to modern physics seem like child's play. But it may not be around the corner. We in the 20th century may be as far away from the solution of the UFO problem as 19th century physicists were from an interpretation of the Aurora Borealis. It is under those circumstances still incumbent upon us as scientists to document and study the phenomenon to the best of our ability. But at present, however, the absence of continued scientific study of the phenomenon still leaves it unclear as to whether genuinely new empirical observations exist. Yet even the Condon report left unexplained nearly a quarter of the cases examined. The fourth observational category contains those UFO reports involving radar. Those are the R's. There are many reports in this category from responsible persons, pilots and control tower operators and so forth. I have paid little attention personally to radar cases since I'm no radar expert, and the radar expert at Blue Book invariably ascribed all radar cases to malfunction or anomalous propagation. Sometimes I felt on the grounds that since UFOs didn't exist, there could be no possible other solution. The Condon report, however, contains the following remark about one such case, quote, "This must remain as one of the most puzzling radar cases on record, and no conclusion is possible at this time." It seems inconceivable that an anomalous propagation echo would behave in the manner described, even if anomalous propagation had been likely at a time, close quote. Radar visual cases offer more scope for study. The Lake and Heath case, studied by the Condon Committee, contains remains an unknown. Lithgow remarked, quote, in summary, this is the most puzzling and unusual case in the radar visual file. The apparently rational, intelligent behavior of the UFO suggests a mechanical device of unknown origin as the most probable explanation of sighting. However, in view of the inevitable fallibility of witnesses, more conventional explanations of this report cannot be entirely ruled out, close quote. In truth, as a matter of fact, if one reads the body of the Condon report carefully, not just the press summary, one finds, at least I find, that it constitutes about as good a case for the scientific study of UFOs as I feel would have been possible by any group not initially conversant with the subject and having limited time and funds. Some of you may be surprised to learn that a considerable body of excellent UFO reports exists. I think we can toss the slide now. We have lights, please. We have really here the crux of the problem. Neither you, as informed active scientists, nor the public have access to this information. Unfortunately, you who may wish to be informed about UFOs must get your information in the intellectual alleys where it is written like forbidden words on the back fences of literature, the pulp magazines, the sensation, adventure, mystery, and sex magazines. There is in this country not one scientific journal in which I could publish a well-documented UFO case. Yet a recent bibliography of UFO literature of all and sundry sorts ran to 400 pages. It would appear that the UFO has become a problem for the librarian sooner than it has for the scientist. Consider, too, the plight of a serious UFO witness. I know they exist because I've interviewed several hundred. Where can they go to report? Only the most naive would have reported to the Air Force during the last years of rulebook. To report to the local police is scarcely better. Many witnesses have told me of the ridicule they met when they took that path. Besides, I've seen many police blotters. UFO reports are entered as complaints. The witness, if he wishes to report, must seek out the relatively few persons or organizations which will lend a sympathetic ear. My own mail brings me many high sigma, high P reports, generally with a request for anonymity, but I have neither time nor the funds to make proper investigation. As I look back over the past 21 years' association with the UFO problem, I note that the intellectual climate today is much better for taking a good look at it than it was even a few years ago. This symposium is itself an example. It would have been impossible to have held it even a year or two ago. In fact, it was impossible to hold it last year. And had I, years ago, when I realized the nature of some of the reports in the Air Force files, attempted to call for a major investigation, I would simply have been labeled a nut and would therefore have lost all possible future effectiveness. In summary, then, the results of my 21 years of monitoring of UFO reports is, one, reports of UFO observations exist after the deletion of the pronouncements of crackpots, visionaries, and religious fanatics. Two, a large number of UFO reports are readily identifiable by trained investigators as misperceptions of known objects and events, and I should add their hoaxes also, and obvious mental disturbance. Three, a small residue of UFO reports are not so identifiable. These, A, are widely scattered over the earth and come from such widely separated places as northern Canada, Australia, South America, and Antarctica. B, are made by competent, responsible, psychologically normal people, that is, credible witnesses. C, contain descriptive terms which collectively do not specify any known physical event, object, or process, and which do not specify any known psychological event or process. At least, not to me, since I cannot speak for the psychologist then. D, resist translation into terms that do apply to known physical and or psychological events, objects, processes, etc. That is, as Gouge points out, translation would alter the meaning of the original report and hence effectively violate the methodological criteria governing the advance of science, which, as he states, are, one, it must be possible for new observational data to occur. That is, the existing conceptual framework of science or the attitudes of scientists must not rule out such new data a priori. Two, that the existing conceptual framework must allow new concepts, principles, laws, etc. to be formulated to interpret and explain the new observational data. Finally, may I say that although I know of no hypothesis that adequately covers the mountainous evidence, this should not, nor must not, deter us from following the advice of Schrödinger to be curious, capable of being astonished, and eager to find out. Thank you.